and welcome to another episode of Tell Them Who You Are. My name is Brandon Farmahini, and I am super happy to have with me a city councilman for one of the biggest cities in the United States, Mr. Jimmy Flanagan. Jimmy, tell the people hello.
Hi, Brandon. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm super excited to have you, actually. But, you know, before we kind of delve into you and everything that, you know, have kind of got you to this point, I think actually it's kind of necessary to explain to people what the hell city council is. Because I think a lot of people assume incorrectly, if my understanding is correctly, that it's a part of government. But in reality, it's a separate component of your city government that has some kind of oversight over what the government does and what the priorities are, but I'm sure you can better explain it than I can.
So it is different in every city, which is what makes it's complicated, right? And it's hard for folks to learn this stuff in school because people move and they get jobs in other cities, and so it's not always clear. In Austin and in similar cities, San Antonio is very similar. Dallas has a lot of similarities. The city council and the mayor are the same body. So the mayor doesn't have like a veto like a president or a governor. He is a council member, but is elected by the whole city. And the council decides the policy, so kind of the rules of the road, and the budget, the amount of the tax rate, and in what buckets those tax dollars should go. And that's kind of it. We then hire a manager who then handles and is responsible for all the day-to-day stuff. So he's responsible for hiring and firing staff. He's responsible for interpreting the rules that the council sets up. But it is, so all of the really complicated, you know, which pothole gets filled first, that's decided by the manager, not by the council. And there are always folks in the community who are like, why haven't you filled my pothole yet? I'm like, I'll go get my hard hat. Hold on, I'll be right there. Like it's Ron Swanson or something. It's an actual episode of Parks and Rec.
Yeah, and I think Parks and Rec, if anybody really wants to understand how local government works, I do think Parks and Rec is a pretty good representation, right?
It is shockingly close. And I think anyone in government is a huge fan of that show. Local government is a huge fan of that show. And the episode where they have the debate, I can attach people I've run against into each of the categories of the people in that comedy show represented in the races that I've run.
Yeah, we'll touch on that a little bit. So can you explain a little bit how you made that transition or got interested in transitioning from a private citizen to a member of the local government?
Well, you know, the path is different for everyone who gets into local politics. Some folks work in government, they're a civil servant, and then they get to a place where they want to be in the policymaking side of it. For me, I thought I was going to be in business. I had a web development company. I was building websites for 20 years, self-employed. And I got involved in small business advocacy, first with the Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, now the LGBT Chamber of Commerce here in Austin. And I rose to kind of through the ranks, as it were, was the president of that organization a couple of times. And because of that, started to see the real impact local government had on our daily lives. And I was originally advocating for the needs of small businesses, especially LGBT-owned businesses, which, you know, up until last week's Supreme Court ruling, could be fired from your job for being gay in Texas, literally up until last week.
Thank you, John Roberts. That was a surprise.
Well, I have a theory about that. You can ask me about that theory if you want.
We don't have the time on another podcast.
There was just a point in that advocacy as a small business leader in the LGBT chamber. And I would go to this like community meeting and they'd say, we want to have a conversation about how the city can be better for small business. And they'd convene this meeting with like 100 people and they'd put us in tables of 10 and each table would have a facilitator. Each facilitator would have a little whiteboard and they'd write down all of our ideas and they'd do this at each of the tables. And then they'd give each table a sheet of colored dots and they'd say, get up and walk around to all the other sheets and put your colored dots on the things that you think are the most important thing. We'd all stand up and we'd go around this room. It was like this whole physical exercise we'd put through. It was cool, right? Because you could see like all these great ideas. You're like, oh, I like that one. I like that one. And you do this whole thing. And then we all went home. And then 5 years later, we're back again at the convention center with the facilitators and the whiteboards and the colored dots. And I realized that unless I was up on the dais, I couldn't actually affect the level of change I felt was necessary in the community. And that's when I started thinking about going bigger than being a small business owner and being a public servant in a community.
So that brought you to city council election. And not to get too in the weeds, but Austin used to be have six citywide council positions. And in the year that you first ran, that changed to geographic districts.
Well, the districts are very different. And, you know, so the old system where you had the six at large and the mayor was basically like having seven mayors. All seven people on the council got elected by the whole city. But as a practical matter, they were getting elected primarily by voters in central Austin, in the center part of the city. And Austin, as you know, has a pretty big suburban sprawl component. My entire district, I think, is fairly described as suburban sprawl. And I don't use it as an attack line. Sure. It's just the reality of how my part of town got built. And for years and years and years and years, this seven mayors system basically represented the interests of central Austin. And finally, there was a citizen-led effort. The mayor pro tem, Delia Garza, was a part of that, as were a few others, that said, you know what, we need to get serious about this districts thing. And it had been tried and failed in the past, but it finally passed. And in my district, far northwest Austin, it is, I think, fairly described as the most conservative of the 10 city council districts. It is one, it is kind of a middle class. It is not the wealthiest district, but it is certainly not the poorest district. It has very high voter turnout. So in my district, you'll get 30, 40,000 voters. In other districts, you might have 10 or 15,000 voters. Even though the population of those districts is relatively the same, that population includes children and immigrants and non-voters. But my part of town, the kind of the western side, which has traditionally been kind of the power of the city.
Yeah, I think
my part is like west, but by proxy. Like we're west and then keep going till starlight. Yeah. Like it's like the Peter Pan of city count of the city, like just on till morning, and then you'll get to my district.
I guess you guys get about 30,000 voters, it seems like, or at least 30,000 that are participating in your seat or so.
Yeah, in 2014, the first election for districts, 25% of the people that voted for governor, which was then at the top of the ticket, 25% did not vote at the bottom of the ballot where the city council race was located. And in my district, that was the highest drop up of the whole city.
Yeah, because I guess in Texas, you know, we used to vote by ticket, straight ticket. So you just log your ticket, Republican or Democrat, and then book it.
City council is nonpartisan. So right. City and school board in Texas don't have a D or a R next to their name on the ballot. And this election will be the first one without a straight ticket option. So it is kind of unknown what impact that's going
to
have.
Long. I voted with the new touchscreen system. And when you go from one to the other, like down the list, it takes a while. So anticipate all the normal problems we're going to have with voting because of coronavirus and then times, you know, 10.
All the more reason for vote by mail.
All the more reason for vote by mail. So can you describe what was your 2014 campaign like?
Oh, gosh. 2014 was a crazy cycle because it was the first one with districts. Now we alternate. Half the districts go one year, the other half go the other year. But in 2014, all of them happened at the same time. It's the only time in history or in the future that that will occur. So there were 78 people across the city running for city council all at the same time across these districts. 78 candidates vying for attention, vying for donors, vying for media. It was crazy. I always call it the rugby scrum election. It was just everybody jumped in and there were unqualified people. There were qualified people. It was wild.
And a light rail ballot on top of that, that was getting like, you know, most of the citywide attention.
Yeah. And so there was the light rail ballot on there too, where I think all but two or three of the 78 candidates, myself included, opposed that rail item. There just wasn't.
You opposed 2014?
I absolutely did. I absolutely
We're
did.
We're building it now.
Yeah.
We're building the 2014 plan now.
We are not.
We could be an expansion. We could be in expansion mode right now.
No, sir. No, sir. No, sir. That is not what we're
doing
right now.
It went from Grove to Highland, which is going to be the blue and gold line.
What we are building now is
we would have missed out on the tunnel, maybe.
But it is more than that. If we want to relitigate 2014, I will relitigate some 2014.
All I'm saying, sir, is we could have voted yes then and then voted again in 2020 like we are now to expand the system.
No,
and we would have ended up with the same thing.
We would not have ended up with the same thing. That is completely not true.
All right. So your opponent, I don't want to use his name because I'm generally afraid that he'll sue me. your opponent was crazy.
Is. I think you meant to say is.
Is still crazy. I think he's running right now for, I don't know, state senate or something.
Yeah, a special election for state senate.
What was the challenge going against, not like a conventional candidate? I mean, he's almost Trump before Trump.
Hey, he would describe himself that way, actually. There were moments on the campaign trail in 2016. So I lost to him in 14 and then beat him in 16 in a rematch. And, you know, there were times where he compared himself favorably to Trump in the 2016 race. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't like to speak ill of the dead.
You're such an asshole.
What I want to say, right as you were taking a drink, I think voters are looking for authenticity.
Sure.
They want to know that their elected officials are being direct, they're cutting through the BS. I don't know that they care if their elected official is right as much as they want to know that they trust the words coming out of their mouth.
Sure.
And there were other candidates in that 2014 race, and I ended up in a runoff with the guy who won, who I then beat, and I lost that runoff by 191 votes in a quick December runoff. And then, of course, when I came back in 16, beat him with 56%. But he and I have some similarities, as much as I hate to admit it. We're both very direct. We cut right to the chase. We don't pull any punches. You know, we have a clear perspective on certain issues, and we're not afraid to communicate that perspective. And I think ultimately that's what voters are craving. That's what voters want
to
see.
Yeah, I think that was one of the first things I noticed when you got to council in, I guess, early 17, was you called it like you saw it.
Yeah.
And one thing that I would especially appreciate, I think a lot of people really do, is let's not be scared of making decisions and vote to delay it. Let's make the decision. We're going to have to make it at some point, because I think a frustration a lot of people have, and I saw it in Austin specifically pre-17, if there's any kind of like back and forth, well, let's just wait and make the decision later. Let's table it. And it's like, look, it's going to be a hard decision 2 months from now. It's going to be a hard decision today. Let's make it and move on. And I felt like that kind of honesty and willingness to talk openly about how the council is making decisions and not make it seem like something that's taboo was refreshing.
You know, that happens really at every level of government. It's so easy. If you're the person in government who doesn't like a proposal, you don't like the thing being proposed, you don't actually say you don't like it. What you say is, oh, there should be more public engagement. There should be more analysis. We don't have all the data yet. And as it turns out, it's impossible to have perfect engagement and perfect data. So it becomes a strategy for naysayers, and it happens on the outside too, but elected officials can also do it, where they just keep calling for more analysis until you either get new elected officials who don't care about that item so much, or you can bury it under a weight of study and reporting and consultants to the point at which you've talked it to death.
For instance, in Austin, it's been quite a long time. I think almost 30 years since the land development code has been completely redone. And in the latest pushes against it, we've heard, well, why are we going so quickly? But this process, along with the, I think, Imagine Austin initiative before it, has been going on for more than 10 years. How long do you need?
Yeah, Austin is the fastest growing city in America on the whole. Meaning that every 15 years, the population doubles, or every 10 years, it adds 20. There's some number, some ratio that seems impossible that has been true since the day the city was founded. It's not a result of the tech boom. It's not a result of hippies in the 70s. It is how this city is constructed. And the land development code, the book by which everything gets built, the rules by which things get built, was written and approved in the one moment in time where Austin wasn't growing. It was in the 80s during the real estate crash. And that's the moment when they passed all the rules for development, all of the rules, relatively speaking, that we operate under today. And so for folks who are frustrated about how their city is growing, about how Austin is growing, which is literally everybody, why are we using rules from the real estate crash era? Why aren't we thinking about the future? And we spent the last, I think, 8 years debating that in fits and starts. And some of it, you know, was bad timing, right? They initiated a rewrite process and then 2 years later completely changed the form of government. And then 2 years later changed the city manager. And then a year later, the lead guy in charge of data passed away. Like, it was just a real a real bad, unfortunate series of events, right? Where by the time we got to the end, it was very easy to say, we don't have enough data, we don't have enough engagement. And with a thing as complicated as line development code, there's always something you can find in that document that you don't like. And I didn't like everything in the document either. And I think it's telling that the reason why it ended, the reason why we are in this ginormous pause button, is over a process complaint working its way through the courts, not a policy complaint, a process complaint. Because as I said, that's how you kill stuff in government. You just focus on bad process and you can kill anything.
Yeah, yeah, it's frustrating. And I think, you know, the more we can get rid of that in local government, the better. So would you say that you have any kind of philosophy when it comes to governing the city or how the city should grow? Would you call yourself an urbanist, for example, or do you feel like you're taking more of a piece by piece view of how decisions should be made and how the city should be overseen?
I think of myself as a pragmatist. There are people who call me an urbanist. There are people who call me a lot of things, frankly. but I don't think the labels are super helpful in this context, because every choice before us has its own set of circumstances. And I think about, you know, growth as a practical reality of when you have a great city. Cities that don't grow have problems. You don't want to be that city. And, you know, frankly, the same thing applies to traffic, by the way. If you don't have traffic, sure, that means something's wrong, like, say, a pandemic. Which also, as I've heard, of course, I haven't left my house, but for like twice in the last 4 months, I heard there's already traffic again. Like,
that's insane.
Good Lord. Like, what? How even? Stay home, people. Wear your masks. Oy.
They have to see their local hospital filled up. That's what it's going to be. Anyway.
What? You built the hospital. You might as well use it. Is that the theory? Like, good Lord. yeah, you know, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. And trying to find pragmatic solutions. You know, I have folks that consider me fiscally conservative. I don't typically use the word conservative to describe myself. I'm the first openly gay man to serve on the city council. But I am pragmatic, and I am concerned about the bottom line. And I think that if we looked at city governance in a way that we considered the types of functions where you don't want a business to do it, like policing, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be privatizing police. Those are the things that government should do. And yes, they will take longer, and there will be more public engagement, and there will be more bureaucracy, but that's the, and more transparency, which you don't get with private business. You don't get transparency with private business. And then there are things
that's why we formed governments in the first place.
Right. And then there are things that shouldn't be government's job, but government might be able to facilitate, or use government's got to set the guardrails on. And when we talk about growth in the city of Austin, and really any city, it's always the hardest question. These are always the hardest questions that trip up city councils. You really have to consider the economy. You have to consider the economic incentives that drive behavior. And know that you can't just regulate it away. There will be impacts. And on one hand, you might set up a system, which I would argue is kind of the system we have in Austin right now, where it's very difficult to build new housing. Therefore, the housing you have is incredibly expensive. It's really one sentence.
Yeah.
Now, when you start to unpack that and say, all right, well, let's make housing easier to build. Well, it's more complicated than one sentence, because now you got to talk about how much more and where. And what does it look like? And who gets to own it? And how much does it cost? And all those things. And they're all valid questions that we need to dig into, which frankly we dig into for the last 8 years. And I'm not satisfied with every compromise that was made in order to get to the last version of that compromise earlier this year, but I was ready to move forward, noting a very long and engaged process. But now the courts are in this process conversation. And if a new process is going to be required, either by judicial action or by legislative action next year, then we will revisit this topic again, because the bottom line is we have an unaffordable, economically segregated city being built under a land code from a day, the one day when Austin wasn't growing. And that's just not acceptable.
So, you know, I think the thing that we obviously have to get to, you know, you took office in 2017, you were working in City Hall, you had your meetings twice a month, 2017, 2018, 2019. Then we get to 2020. And in March, COVID comes. And it comes to Austin. Comes everywhere. How has your perception of your job and your role and what is on your plate and I guess just everything shifted between the 3 years leading up to this point, probably about when, at least in Austin time, we canceled South by Southwest.
Well, and I, you know, credit to Mayor Adler for making that call. You know, and like I said earlier, in this system, the decisions are made by the body, by all 11, but this one exception, the mayor actually has these emergency powers created in the state constitution, and he's using them. And I think he's doing a good job with that. And I think the decision to cancel South by.
A lot of people were skeptical, and I think he was proven right over time.
I think the decision to cancel South by will be remembered in history as part of the moment when the nation started to take it seriously. And so credit to Mayor Adler for making that tough call. But now, operating as a body, thinking about the economic consequences, that night, the mayor canceled South by. I was convening musicians and music venue owners in my council office down at City Hall, which was awkward because it was also the night of the People's Gallery, where we open up City Hall to the public to see all the local artists who have put art up on the wall. But I had my office door closed because we were getting to work. Said, oh my gosh, canceling South by is going to harm all of our music venues and our live music scene, and we got to start focusing on that. That then led to a resolution that that I wrote and my colleagues adopted, directing the manager to include significant economic response in our COVID work. Then later, creating a suite of programs to help local business and nonprofits and childcare providers, called the Clear Fund and the Anchor Fund, which Councilmember Alter, Harper Madison, and Ellis helped create. Those programs are about to hit the street. We signed the final contracts in June, just a couple weeks ago. You know, so we've been doing the work. But to your question, Brandon,
because this is more than the work.
The job is the same.
How?
It's the same in that there are problems in our community that require a coordinated response, and it is the job of government to coordinate that response.
The gravity of the needs right now, though.
Well,
I don't mean to diminish like the work that you guys do before COVID, but you know, before, at least in March and April, and then probably coming in now when we're talking about like, are there enough hospital beds? Are people going to be dying in the street? Like, there's no point where you kind of have to stop and just catch your breath for a little bit.
I mean, maybe that time will come when things have calmed down. I'm not catching my breath now. It's too important. But what to your point though, Brandon, I was joking with one of my campaign team folks today, remembering back in 2016, how one of the most controversial topics on the campaign trail was speed bumps. I mean, how quaint does that sound right now? You know, can we go back to a day where our biggest concern was speed bumps? Yeah. I would love to go back to a day where the biggest concern was speed bumps, but the passion was no less than it is now. People care deeply about their community. And even if contextually the problems are small or contextually the problems are big, the passion is the same. And I think it's true for the council and myself included, that we approach this job with that same fervor and excitement to solve the problems, big and small, in the city.
Do you think it's going to help people get along a little bit more positively once we can put this COVID, you know, episode behind us next year? Like, having gone through this experience, do you think people are going to be as adversarial? Like in Austin, like in many places, we had a sports stadium issue, and it's, you know, that every major city deals with it. And tempers were high, you know, emotion was high. There was screaming. I was at City Hall, and one person was escorted out of the room. And then again, you look at it now and you're like, that is just so silly. Do you think that we will better be able to disagree with one another once we feel like we're out of the woods?
I don't describe it as silly. People are passionate about this city, about their neighborhoods, about their community. Mm-hmm. And it is my responsibility to acknowledge that this is a democracy and they have every right, not just a right, but a duty to be passionate and to have their voices heard. And I don't think that will change because I don't think it should change. And whether or not in hindsight something might seem silly is kind of not the point. Will people treat each other with more respect? I think there'll be some of that, but not in the middle of a policy fight, because I don't think there's a reason to cool your heels. I think a passionate, robust public debate is what makes democracy work best. Mm-hmm. So I don't shy away from it. I think people know me that I don't shy away from a robust and passionate public debate. But I also think that I have even reflected upon some of the things that I've said and done and approaches I've taken. And, you know, I don't always have to be that aggressive. I don't always have to be that direct. Sometimes we can get stuff done in a more calm way. And I think there's going to be a lot of that. I think there will be some improvement.
So what have you learned in these, you're almost finished with your first term in office?
I'm always learning. You know, 3.5 years in, every year I learn, I think the job is different than it was the year before. And my staff jokes with me because I'll say, oh, I finally figured out how this job works. And they'll go, really? And they're like, 6 months ago you said, and 8 months before that you said. That's the beauty. It's why, I mean, honestly, it's why I love this job so much, because it is not something that you know how to do. It is a system in which you try to make the best of what you have and the cards you are dealt. And it's such an amazing adventure and an honor to be in this fight. And especially now where, as you said, these issues have reached a level of importance that city councils don't normally have to participate. And frankly, if we had a minimally functional federal government, we wouldn't have to be solving these problems. The federal government would be doing their jobs, because this is the kind of stuff the federal government is responsible for talking about. These big structural ideas is their job, but they're absconding their job. And so it's falling down to us.
So at what point did you realize, either individually or as a collective, that we're alone here? We're going to have to figure this out. We're going to have to lead. We can't wait for the federal government and even the state government. The Texas governor didn't actually get involved in COVID regulations for relatively a long time. At what point did you guys realize that you really had to take control of this? Because if you didn't, everything was going to fall apart.
I got elected the same night Trump got elected. I remember in those first few months, November and December, I was convening constituents, my new constituents, and we were having these house parties. I remember that, of course, the night that I won, it was all very bittersweet. And the next day I posted on my Facebook page that I didn't know how we were going to get through it, but I knew we could do it if we did it together. And I had people sign up. I had 250 people sign up that night. And we started convening these house parties, and they felt very French Revolution. Like, people would drive up and they'd look over their shoulders like, is anybody seeing me walk into this house right now? And then we'd have these packed living rooms. I mean, just packed.
Did you have a secret handshake?
I mean, it was crazy. And I would like walk people through, like, yes, we're gonna gnash our teeth right now because things sound like crap, but let's not give up, because we can't give up. That's not how democracy works. We got to keep going. And so I convened all these kind of French Revolution living room events, and started building a political team and started building a movement in my little corner of the city. And I learned a couple of things. One, no one was approaching the job the way I was approaching it, not in my part of town. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I'm not talking about my colleagues. Every district is different and has different needs.
Sure.
This very intentional organizing, continued organizing approach was new. And once I got in the job, I realized that Austin has for many years assumed the state and federal government was leaving us to our own devices. So there wasn't a moment during the COVID crisis where we assumed the federal government was going to save us. There wasn't a moment during this COVID crisis where we thought the governor was going to save us. We have always known that local government is where government governs best. And in Austin, it's the only level of government that actually governs. And you can see the evidence of that from Governor Abbott's approach to this pandemic. I could not believe that his grand theory of state government is a game of hide and seek to find the loopholes. Are you kidding me?
All right. So for those of you who obviously aren't aware, the governor of Texas made a proclamation which basically took out local control across all the major municipalities, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, El Paso. And it wasn't until a couple weeks ago where it became very obvious COVID was getting much worse in the state. And the governor started feeling a little fire to his feet, where a San Antonio judge used a rationale that he was not requiring citizens to wear masks. He was requiring businesses to require people in those businesses, both employees and patrons, to wear a mask. And then Governor Abbott, feeling the pressure, as some of you have seen on Twitter with the resign Abbott hashtag trending, was just like, ha ha, congratulations. It's like you're on a saga and he's like, you know, the troll that pops out. He's like, you discovered like the magic loophole. I can't believe it took all of you guys this long. It's like
the joke I made, Brandon, on Twitter was, is the governor actually Glinda the Good Witch? We had the power within us all along.
How many of things does that apply to in state government? How much can we change? I feel like every time we do anything, we get sued.
Well, and that's the point, right? The governor saying that there was some magic loophole that allows local government to protect its citizens is BS, because 2 months prior, as the county judge in Dallas County was enforcing their ordinances, there was a business owner who decided to engage the right-wing conspiracy universe to stop it. And the governor changed his statewide orders to protect her.
Yeah.
So no, governor, we can't just go find your loopholes, because you've shown that if we do, you'll just change your order.
Yeah, I think he just said, hey, by the way, all the salons open tomorrow. And I think everybody was just like, what? Like, no, stick to the plan.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you described local government the way you did, because I think both you and myself were pretty big Mayor Pete Buttigieg supporters in the Democratic primary. Am I remembering that correctly?
Oh, yeah.
And people would ask me why I like him. And, you know, I have to be honest, a part of it is just I believe it's time for a new generation to emerge in leadership. But also, I do think that mayors, especially more than members of Congress, understand how to govern. They understand accountability to the people, to their constituents, and they understand how to run a fat and layered bureaucracy. But how does your experience in local government affect your previous advocacy for Mayor Pete?
Well, you know, like I said, I'm the first openly gay man to be on the Austin City Council. Randy Shade was the first woman. She served back in 2009 and was a mentor of mine. So having the first kind of legitimate major LGBT candidate was a big part of my openness to his candidacy. But as I got to know him, and I benefited from Mayor Adler, Austin's Mayor Adler, he was close friends with Mayor Pete. And so I benefited from getting to know them more than most people would get to know them. It became clear that his experience, both as a veteran and as a mayor, informed his potential as a president in a way that really felt right to me. This is not about all mayors are perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this policing conversation shows that there are still some mayors out there that have a lot to learn about how to represent their communities. But the experience of municipal government is one that I often describe as there are no excuses and no escape. If you screw up in local government, you see your constituents at the grocery store. There's no getting out of that. And every decision you make, you think about that moment. And it's not that only a mayor should be president, but you should have had some local government experience at least. Mm-hmm. And there were other candidates that had that, right? I mean, even Bernie Sanders had some local government experience.
Yeah, back in like the 17th century.
You know, but nonetheless, what it means to have the responsibility of leadership in a community that you also have to be in all the time.
Sure.
So there were multiple reasons why I supported Mayor Pete, but that one was definitely high on the list.
So I'm glad you brought up, you know, the protests and the move to police accountability. Were you as kind of shocked, I guess, as I was, that the Black Lives Matter movement revived itself to such an incredible degree amid this national pandemic and spread so rapidly from Minneapolis to all the major cities in the United States to a lot of non-major cities in the United States and to cities around the world?
This is not a new movement. And there are parts of it that feel new, like the scale feels new, right? But we've seen this happen over prior incidents in policing in the past.
We have many, many times.
Right, you go back to the LA riots and show there have been these huge, ginormous scaled events. And the Black and brown community leaders that have been fighting for reform for many, many, many years are sometimes being unfairly, not by you, Brandon, of course, but I'm saying just in generally, they're being unfairly kind of pigeonholed as like, this is coming out of nowhere and you're asking for too much too fast. And in fact, in Austin, just in Austin, many of these leaders were in my office over the last 2 years asking for these very things.
Sure.
And I didn't know how to interpret it then. And so I listened, and there were some ideas that, as it turns out, I was just using different words, but we actually had some similar ideas. And there were other things that I wasn't sure we could find a path forward through the politics on, and other issues. But I don't think we can discount what it means to have these moments during the pandemic. The pandemic is the part that's unprecedented, not the calls for police reform. That is not unprecedented. That is very precedented.
Yeah, no. I didn't say like it came from.
No, I'm just laying this out for your audience, right?
Okay.
So, right, Black Lives Matter is not a new phrase. Defund the police is not a new phrase. No. Even abolish the police is not a new phrase. Those phrases have been used, but now it isn't just the Black community who sees problems in the system. The pandemic has shown our entire system is fragile, and not everybody was benefiting. And as it turns out, no one is safe. Anyone can be screwed by the system if it breaks in just the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, opening people's minds to a scale of reform that was not politically possible in the past. And that's what excites me about this moment. Not the calls for whatever phrase you think is upsetting you, but that you could actually go back and look and say, well, why do we have officers doing 100 jobs?
Yeah.
Why are we sending fire trucks to heart attacks? Why aren't we sending an ambulance to a heart attack? Like, why are we so misdirecting these resources in the wrong ways? And maybe we can actually do this better and cheaper at the same time. I am very excited to be in this moment. I feel very fortunate to be in this moment at this time. And to have the trust of my city council colleagues, I am the chair of our new public safety committee as a council.
Brag about it.
I mean, truly, for the one white dude who isn't the mayor, there are only two white dudes and one of us is the mayor. For my colleagues to trust me to have that leadership role in this moment is possibly the greatest honor of my life.
Well, congratulations. I didn't mean to joke about it. It is tremendously important. And my council member is the only African-American member of the council. And I know she puts a lot of trust in you as well. But you realize that the good is going to come, but it's also the bad and the responsibility. So how do you juggle these competing claims of interest between people who are concerned that if there is a matter of public safety and the police aren't going to have the funds to be there versus the people who think the police are too militarized, there's too many of them, they don't have proper training? How do you juggle that battle within the community right now?
The more I talk to folks about it, the more I realize there's not disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
We are getting tripped up in the words. Whenever you hear folks who are skeptical, I'm going to use very intentional, easy language.
Sure.
The emotions are much deeper than this, but I'm being very intentional. When you hear folks who are skeptical of these reform concepts, they often cite kind of straw man arguments. You know, if there was a guy in your home with a gun, you would want a police officer to show up. Yeah. And we would send one.
Yeah.
That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is when I saw an officer tweet that there was a disabled car on the side of the road and he pulled over and helped the guy like get to the gas station and fill up his gas tank. And what a cool thing that was. And it was a cool thing. Why is the officer doing it? The state of Texas has a program called HERO, where they patrol state highways looking for disabled vehicles and helping them get off the road. Why aren't we doing more of that instead of asking our officers to also help disabled vehicles? And when you start scratching at the surface and digging into the 911 calls and things that are being responded to, you start to realize that we are asking officers to do things that officers don't have to do. That's the point. It's not that there's nothing officers have to do. I did a ride-along with an APT officer. This was about a year and a half ago. And it was very eye-opening because we spent a majority of that officer's shift transporting folks to the mental hospital and taking a non-aggressive young man into central booking for a DWI. And we sat in central booking for 4 hours waiting for this guy to be processed. What a waste of the community's resources. Why are we having to do all that? And part of it is there are some state laws that we have to go back and revisit that require officers to do certain things and maybe shouldn't have to be an officer to do certain things. And sometimes it's because we had the officers, we send them. It's almost an inertia problem. And it's going to take a lot of effort to dial that back.
How do you deal with the other side of it?
What's the other side?
Like, I'm sure you're familiar with the Mike Ramos case. And I've seen this before on Nextdoor. Somebody called 911 claiming that he was waving a gun around and he did not have a gun. And I've seen on Nextdoor people lie to their neighbors and say, oh, well, if you want a cop to come, make sure to say this. And because that cop was told that this person has a gun, and the person was, I think, with a friend or two, and they were in their car on a public street, there's nothing they were doing was illegal. That officer shot this young man dead. How do you deal with a community that's paranoid and possibly racist and get them to be a little bit more responsible? How do you get them to not call the police every time somebody is legally within their rights walking down the street or in their car on a private street?
I had someone propose, in some cities, they will charge a fine to someone who calls 911 for suspicious person if that person is just black, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just cutting to the chase here.
Yeah.
In some cases, we have a culture problem, but you don't solve a cultural problem by sending police. You address culture through, you know, solid community leaders like faith leaders having difficult conversations. You do it through public information campaigns. You do it through a lot of other tactics.
But you would send.
You don't do it by hiring 30 more cops.
You would send a police officer, though, if somebody was waving a gun around.
Right. What you asked is, what do we do about if someone claims that and it's not true?
Right. Which is this was not an isolated. I guarantee you. And in fact, when this incident happened, I was like, somebody needs to go on that neighborhood's next door. I bet you somebody posted about this. Like, how do you get people to quit trying to use the police as their own form of paranoia enforcement?
I mean, depending on which advocates you talk to, that is why the police was created. I mean, you are talking about the types of cultural and structural change that are unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be... My answer to that question is not easy, and it's not going to be something we do in August.
Sure, definitely.
Right? The city's heading to a budget adoption in August, and there's a lot of folks focused on that because it'll be the first formal decision the council can make about the future of the police budget. But those types of questions are not solved in a single budget vote. But there are things that can be addressed, and we got to be careful not to let ourselves be focused on what we think the one problem is when there are 10 problems.
Sure.
Let's start solving them in order, right? Let's take the easiest stuff first, the fastest stuff first, start identifying and working on the medium-term stuff, and then take the long-term stuff and parcel it out to other groups. I mean, there's just ways to start doing this work in an intentional way, and that's what I'm trying to do with the Public Safety Committee that I now chair.
Dude, it is...
We're going to be putting out a whole new schedule of meetings. We're going to start doing more public conversations. And I want to be really clear, because if we say, I'm going to have more public conversations, that sounds like that process thing I talked about earlier in your show. I am not screwing around with this. There are necessary conversations to have, but I am intentional about seeing big structural reform. That structural reform happens in policy. It happens in budget. It happens in public information. It happens in a whole host of ways. And it's not just going to be stuff the council does. We're all as a community going to have to do this work together.
I'm so happy that you phrased it as like, let's knock down these problems one by one by one. Just today, we didn't have a ribbon cutting, but we opened up a traffic circle, kind of like a small roundabout in our neighborhood that we have been working for years to get. And one of the first comments by the neighborhood, you know, grump, was, well, how does this help slow down traffic on the other end of the street a mile away? I'm like, bro, it doesn't, man. We're working on that too, but like this itself solves a problem. It doesn't solve everything. I think that's a great message.
That, Brandon, that logical reasoning approach, that logical fallacy is a Russian disinformation tactic called whataboutism.
Yeah, there you go.
I always like to remind folks of that when it's used. No American should want to be accidentally using Russian disinformation tactics.
Maybe he does work for the Kremlin. I don't know. Before we go...
He works for Trump, so that's all I know.
There you go. He is. He's the one person in our neighborhood with the Trump sign. Before we go, there is actually one thing a little more, I guess, relatively lighthearted, but very cool that I'd like to talk to you about. One thing that I've really enjoyed is the way that you've embraced... I guess the phrase is new media. Obviously, every city council member has a Twitter account when they're running. Some of them continue using their Twitter account, but you've been much more aggressive with making videos. You have your own video blog, which you should definitely plug. So what is your approach in using new media and using the different tools and social avenues that are available to you to better connect to your constituents of today?
I mean, you have to go where the people are, right? Isn't that a line from Beauty and the Beast? I want to go where the people are. No, that's from Little Mermaid. Thank you. I told you I was the gay council member. One Broadway reference required. One Broadway reference.
Little Mermaid's Broadway?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
And Disney. Yeah. And yeah.
I'm very uncultured, so I have no idea.
Yeah, secretly playing the role of Ursula on Broadway would be my, like, if I wasn't a council member, dream job. I'd do a mean karaoke of Poor Unfortunate Souls. Anyway.
I'm going to see that someday.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, my district, my far northwest corner of the city, like I said, is very middle class. It's very tech heavy. I have the Apple campus is in my district. I have a lot of tech workers. And so a lot of my constituents are using these tools. And I'm comfortable with them because I'm a web developer myself. And so I have the talent and the skills over a career to just try some stuff and see how it goes. So I am active on social media. I started my live show that you said I do a live show every Friday on Facebook and YouTube, simulcast Facebook and YouTube, called The Clawback, which is a reference to my campaign logo, which is a hammer. So it's called The Clawback. And I started doing that last October. And then with the onset of the pandemic, I switched up my platform and now I bring on guests. And so I do a live show with guests every Friday. And I've even helped some of my colleagues be introduced to those tools. So now the mayor does one called Got a Minute. And Councilmember Harper Madison does one, I think, called Talking with Tasha, which is awesome. And her stuff is her design work is amazing on her live shows. Beating my pants off on that. But that's how I see it. We should all be trying to innovate and see what works and see what doesn't work, and we'll all get better as a result. And I enjoy that part of this job because I think a big part of being an elected official is staying in communication with your constituents.
Cool. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much. Would you like anything to plug? How about your website? You have a re-election coming up?
Yeah, so I'm on the ballot in November. You can go to my website, jimmyflanagan.com. You can find me Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. You can look for my live show. Like I said, my council district is arguably the most conservative. And so I do have an opponent on the ballot. Some folks don't know that I have an opponent who comes from a pretty conservative right-wing side of the universe. And that is the last thing this community needs in this most difficult moment. So if anyone can help me out.
And that description's an understatement.
Yeah. So you can go on there, jimmyflanagan.com, and make your campaign donations today.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Jimmy. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brandon.
If you like this interview, please check out our sister podcast, Wrong Side of 30 and 90 Day Soiree. Thank you.